Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. I say every Saturday, but next week is an exception because of Bulldog football at Louisiana Tech. We will not have Hometown Heroes next week. We'll be back the following week. And that means this is our last show before Veterans Day. So I want to remind you to make sure to check out your community, see what Veterans Day events are happening. In Fresno, one of the largest Veterans Day parades in the country is going on. So I hope you'll be in downtown Fresno for that. If you're in Visalia, they have a great program at the Fox Theater that gets underway at 1 o'clock. A pancake breakfast before that from 7 to 11. And the guest of honor this year in Visalia is going to be Mae Lam, a 92-year-old Army nurse, a decorated nurse who was at the Battle of the Bulge, served with Patton's 3rd Army. The theme this year for the Visalia Veterans Committee is Women in Service, so you can look forward to that as well. I'm in Visalia this week, enjoying the scenery at the Visalia Country Club with a guy who's been a member here since 1953, Steve Marusich. But if a couple kamikazes had aimed a little better at him on February 21st of 1945, he wouldn't be sitting here with me. Last week, we heard from a Marine Corps veteran who was injured on Iwo Jima. Steve was injured just off of that island on the USS Bismarck Sea. But before we hear about that February 21st story, Steve, let's talk about your early years. You are in a part of the country that I'm familiar with because I went to school up in Syracuse. You're from just south of there, Binghamton, New York. So I guess it doesn't get too cold for you in Visalia or Ivanhoe, does it?
Not very cold, but it is comforting to be here and not have to worry about the snow we used to get in Binghamton.
And maybe that's why you spend so much time on the golf course, because you can. And if you're out there listening, you recognize that name, Steve Marusich. Maybe he was your principal in Ivanhoe, or maybe he beat you on the golf course. He's a 3-time club champion here at Visalia Country Club. And you last shot your age at age 74, is that right?
Yes, that's the last time I was able to keep the ball in the fairway and made a few putts.
He's got 3 career holes in one, but we won't talk about that so much today. If you've ever been on the golf course with him, you know how good he is. And I guess maybe when you get to 90, you'll shoot your age again. Is that the plan, Steve? You're 86 now.
Yeah, it's true. I'm looking forward to it, and it's a pleasure. I play golf 3 days a week with some of my old buddies, and it's always fun to see if we can shoot our age.
Well, you're looking good, and you come from a big family. I mentioned Binghamton, New York. I guess one of the ways you keep warm in that winter is huddling up with all your siblings. Tell us how big your family was.
Well, my mother had 12 children and 3 sets of twins, and only 9 of us survived that marriage. And my mom and dad, we enjoyed the Depression years with 9 of us siblings, and we had a very good time, and none of us realized we were poor, but I'm telling you, we had a lot of fun.
And of those 9 children, you and 3 of your brothers ended up in the service in World War II?
Yes, my mother and my dad, and my mom especially, worried about us. There were 4 of us in the service in World War II, and all of us fortunately came back, and we were blessed to be home again and enjoy the life in Binghamton, New York.
And it was from Binghamton, New York, that you entered the service. Now, before that, the war had started, and let's talk about that. I like to ask every veteran about December 7th, 1941, and what they remember about that day. Do you remember where you were when you heard that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
Yes. I happened to be singing in our church choir, and we were visiting a church in Corning, New York, and we were on Main Street in Corning looking at the big 200-inch telescope lens that was molded at Corning, and it cracked, so they had it in the center of the street. And that morning, we were walking down the street, and we got the word on the radio that Pearl Harbor was bombed.
Did that register? Did it mean anything to you at the time?
No, it was quite a shock, because none of us at that time were even worried about whether the Japanese were in that position to give us trouble.
And it would be that following spring that you graduated from high school, right, 1942?
Yes, I graduated in June of 42 and went to work for IBM for about 6 months. And then in December, I I left the job, and I enlisted in the Navy in January of 1943.
Well, and even before you got in the Navy, the job that you had was related to the war effort, too. And I think that's what a lot of us can forget when we think back about World War II. We think about 16 million Americans in uniform, but there were so many other millions doing something. Tell us what your job was for IBM during that time between your graduation and your enlistment.
Yes, it's hard to imagine. I was just out of high school, just 18 years old, and IBM had already converted to the war effort, and I was put on a multiple drill press operating machine, and I was drilling holes in a 20-millimeter cannon. And it was quite a job in the basement of this four-story factory, and IBM was really going gung-ho and getting materials ready for the fight against the Japanese and Germans.
So you were doing your part as far as the war effort's concerned, but what made you decide, I'm going to do something else, I'm going to join the Navy?
Well, my brother, my oldest brother, was already in the Navy. He joined in 1939, and he was on the Enterprise, the carrier that was out at sea when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And then my next oldest brother was drafted in the Army, and he ended up out in Miami Beach as a rifle instructor. And I was so anxious. I knew I was going to get drafted. And instead of trying to become a soldier in the infantry, I decided, heck, I'm going to join the Navy and maybe join my older brother in the service.
If they had told you about kamikazes, you'd think you would have made a different decision?
Well, at that time, the kamikaze hadn't come to being. That was a latter part of the war. And I'm telling you, if I knew they were going to start stomping on me, I might have joined the Army. But anyway, I enjoyed the Navy, my experience in the Navy. I became a gunner on a torpedo bomber. I was an observing gunner. That was my training. And then I was put aboard this carrier at San Diego, and we came through Pearl Harbor and out into the Pacific and got ready for our first invasion of the Philippines.
Well, and I want to go back to something else you mentioned. It's funny what a small world it is, but you end up living, and maybe we'll hear some of the story of how you ended up there, but you end up living in Ivanhoe. One of your neighbors is a guy who was on this program, Merle Twible, who told us his story about the day he saved the USS Enterprise. He spent the whole war on that ship. And so here you end up being neighbors of a guy who served on the same ship as your brother.
Yes, yes, Merle and I were good friends because I had the pleasure of meeting his wife on many occasions, and his children went to school at Ivanhoe, where I became a principal during the 60s and 70s and 80s. So his children not only went to school there, but I got to meet Merle in a personal way, and he was very interesting to listen to his efforts during World War II.
It is indeed a small world, and you gave us a little taste of what you ended up doing in the Navy. Is that something you volunteered for, to be a gunner on a torpedo bomber? And tell us what that's like, because if I'm not mistaken, you're flying backwards, right? You're facing the rear of the plane, which I think is enough to make someone queasy just listening to us talk about it.
Well, listen, to those of you that have seen movies and pictures of flak coming up at you and bullets and stuff, and if you're riding backwards, you don't get to see all that stuff. I'd sure hate to be a pilot. They had to be the bravest guys in the world because they could see that stuff coming up, and still they were heading for the target. I'm telling you, America's got to be proud of all the veterans that gave us our freedom during World War II.
No question about it. That's what this program is all about. Now, you end up on a carrier, as you said, an escort-class carrier, the USS Bismarck Sea. Had you ever been on something that big before in your life? What was your first impression of walking on this humongous ship?
Well, I'll tell you, if those of you that haven't been aware of portholes and passageways, you have to step up when you go through the bulkheads. Those hatchways are not level with the deck. They're up about 6 or 10 inches, and if you're not paying attention, you can just not only bark your ankles, but you can sure hit your head a lot. It's really something to learn how to go up one ladder and down another, and you better know port from starboard, because if you go down the ladder the wrong way, you sure can get run over. Yeah, it's tricky getting on board, and the carrier was my first big ship in the Navy, and it was quite an experience getting used to walking the decks of the carrier.
And I think a lot of people have heard the label or the analogy of a floating city. You've got a lot of other guys on board with you. What was the atmosphere, the camaraderie like among you and your fellow sailors?
The most interesting part about being aboard a carrier is we came aboard as an air squadron, and we were on the one deck of the carrier, and we had very little association with the other members of the crew. We kind of did our job on the ship, and that basically ours was to do the work off the carriers, and we didn't get to know the firemen or the engineers or any of the other sailors on board. But since then, we've had several reunions and got to meet some of the other members of our crew.
In fact, you just came back recently from another reunion. How many Bismarck Sea sailors were there?
Well, at this reunion, we had 17. We have probably maybe 100 of us left after 600 of us survived the sinking of our carrier. And we were fortunate to meet at Pensacola, got to see the Blue Angels. And I can tell you, American people, that as citizens, you've just got to be proud of the service that these men provide. And they're very skillful in the air, and those jets really move.
You didn't volunteer to jump up and ride backwards on one of those jets?
My gosh, you ought to see them go by 500 or 600 miles an hour, upside down across the runway. You sure shiver a lot to watch those guys work.
You know, I'm just struck by another question for you. We'll take a break here in a minute and get to more of your experiences on the Bismarck Sea. But knowing your affinity for the game of golf, which you started playing every summer as a kid in Binghamton, New York, continue to play at age 86 three times a week. When you're on that carrier, especially on the flight deck, do you ever have that thought in your head, I wish I could just tee a ball right up here on the edge and hit it out there into the ocean?
That crossed my mind several times. But I'll tell you, there were no golf balls on board. And
no clubs either, right?
No clubs. But I'm telling you, we had a lot of entertainment. The other carriers, we had movies, and they had boxing matches. And so we traded films with other carriers. And so we were fortunate to have, when we weren't in action, it was very pleasant being on board.
It was very pleasant being on board until February 21st, 1945, when the Bismarck Sea met its famous fate. We're going to hear how Steve Marusich experienced that and the rest of his experiences aboard that carrier during World War II, a little bit of what he's done since as well. It's Hometown Heroes. We'll be right back on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. I'm visiting in Visalia today with 86-year-old Steve Marusich, a Navy veteran of World War II. I'm staring at his Purple Heart Medal, and we're going to hear about how he earned that medal. Grew up in Binghamton, New York, has made his home in the San Joaquin Valley for more than a half century now. But let's go back to the 1940s, Steve. You're on an escort class carrier, the USS Bismarck Sea. What was your first taste of battle on your torpedo bomber crew?
Well, our first action was at the island of Leyte when General MacArthur was coming ashore. It was one of the biggest, greatest naval battles in history, as I was told. We had several of our escort carriers, a Jeep carrier. We used to call it the Kaiser Coffin, but anyway, there were about 10 or 12 of those in our task force. There were several large carriers and battle wagons and cruisers, and we started the invasion of Leyte and helped soften up the island so General MacArthur could come ashore. And after that, then we didn't waste any time going through the Mindanao Straits of the Philippines, and we headed for Manila and the South China Sea. And I'm telling you, that's a rough body of water. It's never calm, as I understand it. Anyway, we did some bombing on Manila, and then the Army came ashore, and then we headed back to Peleliu and began to work around the islands of Ulithi to get ready for the invasion of the island of Iwo Jima.
And that, of course, is where the Bismarck Sea would meet its fate. But let me take you back there to the first battle you mentioned there at Leyte. And everyone knows that that's where General MacArthur came ashore. And a lot of times on these landings, we see the landing. We see guys coming ashore, whether it's Marines or, in his case, he's wading ashore with his famous fulfillment of his promise to be back. He shall return, and he did. But for you, when you say softening up, that means that you are flying missions and bombing the heck out of that area of land, right?
Yes, and that was true. But to make things worse, the Japanese had a big fleet in the area, and they were giving us heck. And we were told that Admiral Halsey's supposed to have been with us, and he was up north looking for some of the enemy. As it turned out, we had spent quite a few hours taking care of the Japanese fleet and also trying to get MacArthur ready to go ashore.
And this is the first time that you've actually been up in this plane in a combat situation, right?
Yes, it's exciting, and to know that when you get up there, why, you do your best to soften up the enemy, and then it's always a trick trying to land on that little ship to get back safely on board.
And like you say, you can't see it. You're flying blind because you're looking backwards while the pilot's trying to bring it down. I guess you had to have a lot of trust in your pilot, huh?
That's the way it goes. And the signalman, the man that brings us aboard, he has to be very good at knowing when to flag him off and make him come aboard. So I'm fortunate riding backwards, flying backwards, and I don't see all the excitement.
And every landing was perfect?
Well, not so much perfect, but it was safe.
You never went over the edge into the drink?
No, never had that one. But I'm telling you, it's often we did have those occur. Fortunately, we got all the pilots and crew back.
And while you're up in the air, what kinds of things are you doing? Are you looking for enemy aircraft to fire on? Are you in charge of releasing bombs? What did your duties consist of?
Mine was basically, as my position was an observer, and I was just alert to anything that might be of the enemy. And then our torpedo bomber was not very fast, and so we didn't engage in any real combat. We had a mission to do and drop, mostly dropping bombs on the island as we flew over, and then returning back to the carrier.
As an observer, I know you had a lot to observe. See, can you paint a picture for us of what that looked like when you're up in the air? I imagine when you describe the strength, the size of that task force, that had to be impressive to look out and see all those ships and know that they were on your side.
Yes, and to know that we had the support of other carriers and our fighter planes, those pilots were outstanding, and I think America just maybe doesn't remember back that far, but the heroes we had in those days were all terrific Americans. And as we observed our big fleet, we realized how quickly America got into the war effort, and we were able to give the Japanese all they could handle.
Did you ever think back about what you were doing before the war and those 20-millimeter cannons and then get a chance to see some of those in action?
Well, we had several on board our carrier, and I often wondered as they were doing their job, and our gunners were very good. They were usually the cooks and the bakers and the stewards and stuff that did the firing. And I'm telling you, those guys could really shoot. And I think the accuracy of the guns that Americans made, I think we could be proud that we did a good job in softening up that enemy.
So you drilled the holes in the right spots, huh?
Yes. And I'm telling you that if we didn't have the complete cooperation of those at home and getting us the equipment and materials, I think that we would have a more difficult time trying to defeat the Japanese. They were very industrious, and they were surprisingly well-equipped.
Now, you described the journey that your ship took from there at Leyte and down past Peleliu and the Ulithi's. When you went through all these places, did you ever catch a glimpse of something that really struck you, that kind of put the whole war effort in perspective, or the price that was being paid in perspective for you?
The only time we were really anxious when we were going through the Mindanao Straits, there were so many islands on each side of the straits, that I was just wondering how come the Japanese didn't have gun emplacements there to give us trouble. We went right through those straits and never had a shot. So I don't know why they didn't have fortifications there, but anyway, we got through there, and it was just like a waltz in a park. It was very pleasant weather, and the scenery, the jungles and the foliage of those islands was thick and green. It was just like a pleasure walk until we got into Manila.
What happened when you got to Manila?
Well, then we got orders to make sorties, make flights over the city of Manila and in the neighboring territory, and drop our bombs and strafe the railroads and try to make it a little hazardous for the Japanese to let the American invasion force get in there.
When you were flying those sorties, how much enemy fire did you face? Was there a lot of resistance, or was it light?
There wasn't that much resistance from Manila. We didn't have any other than from the ships at Leyte, but at Iwo Jima, most of our flights were not as much firepower as having to deliver bombs to the island and try to soften it up.
So Iwo Jima, that is an island that has stuck with you the rest of your life for a lot of reasons. What do you remember about arriving there and the task that you thought you were going to face? What were your expectations going into that engagement?
Well, I'll tell you, everyone was excited because it was the biggest fleet of ships I'd ever seen. There were hundreds of ships in the area, battleships, cruisers, heavy cruisers, destroyers, big carriers, and there were about a dozen of us little guys. And we were there for almost a week, and it was our responsibility to fly over the island and drop our bombs and try to make things difficult for the Japanese to get ready so that the Marines could come ashore.
You know, when you call yourself a little guy as an escort carrier, I think these destroyer guys are going to call you and say, little guy, we're the real little guys.
Well, that was true because they played a major role in our survival after we had our problems with the kamikazes at Iwo.
You know, when you say you'd never seen a bigger fleet, a bigger group of ships, when you got to Iwo Jima and you saw so much firepower on the American side, did you ever think, we need all this for this little island? Is that something that occurred to you?
Yes, I was surprised that the Japanese were so well fortified. They had to be all underground because that island was sure peppered every day. For 6 or 7 days, the big 16-inch guns from the battleships and the big carriers had much more firepower than we did, but that was our duty to just go over and drop bombs on the island and see if you could soften them up.
And when you were flying those missions and dropping bomb after bomb and knowing all these other planes were too, did you see anything down below that made you think that this was going to be much of a fight?
No, it didn't look that ominous. It was just an island with very little vegetation, and it was, we were wondering, I kept wondering why the heck we were there, because it didn't look like there was much on the island to be fighting for, although later on I found out that that airstrip was vital to the B-29s to hit Tokyo, so that was our mission, to see if we can't soften it up and maybe give the Marines a better chance to get the island.
But when you're flying and dropping all these bombs and you don't see anything down below, you almost wonder, are we wasting all of this firepower?
Well, that really didn't enter our minds at all. I know we had a mission to do, and we were just doing our part.
What, for people who haven't been there, and I think most of us listening have not been to Iwo Jima, we've certainly seen pictures of the giant mound, Mount Suribachi on one end of the island, and then more of a flat strip going from there. What did it look like to you, and certainly from the air? Was there something striking about that location?
Nothing striking other than Suribachi at one end, and it looked like a simple thing to get that island, but when you found out that there were thousands of Japanese underground and the Marines had a heck of a time getting there because there was very little foliage or shrubs or anything to cover. So when they invaded that island, those Marines were outstanding and to be able to get those Japanese out of there.
And of course, we know what the Marines did. They raised that flag early on in the battle, but spent 5 weeks fighting for that island of Iwo Jima at a heavy price to American forces. Speaking of the flag atop Mount Suribachi, when we come back, we're going to get Steve's recollection. Where did he see that flag from, and what did it mean to him at the time? What does it mean to him now? Steve Marusich, Navy veteran of World War II, our guest today. We'll be back with more of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. It's a Navy week and another Iwo Jima week. A different perspective on Iwo Jima from Steve Marusich, who was on a torpedo bomber crew flying off the flight deck of the escort carrier USS Bismarck Sea. When we left off, he had been flying those missions over Iwo Jima, dropping bombs to try to soften that island up before the Marines made their famous invasion. And early on in that invasion, Steve, after your primary job of hitting the island before the invasion was done, there was a bit of a commotion aboard your carrier. What was that all about?
Well, on the day that we met the enemy, my shipmate and I were sitting on the hangar deck aft on the starboard side, and we were getting ready to go eat. It was about 6:30 at night. And as we were sitting there talking, ready to go and to start our chow that night, why, the guns start firing off and the general quarters sounded. And we stood up and turned towards the bow of the ship. And just as we turned, the first suicide plane hit us about, 20 or 30 feet in, on the starboard side where my shipmate and I were standing. And we were blown down the hangar deck about, I would say maybe 20, 30 feet. And the explosion hit me in the back of the head and my back, my legs. And after laying there a few seconds, I got up and started walking towards the bow of the ship. And not walking very well, I was kind of wondering if my legs were broken or not. Anyway, by the time I got up forward about another 20, 30 yards, the second suicide plane came down and hit our above our after elevator and knocked our torpedoes off, and the torpedoes began exploding, and the ship was damaged very severely. And another half a minute or so, the skipper came on and told us to abandon ship. Moving forward, I went up to the forward gun sponson where there were, I think, 20-millimeter cannons. They had a big line over the side, and I was fortunate. I got up that far, took my helmet off. My jacket was gone. It was blown off my back. And I went over the side on the big line, and after dropping a few feet, we're up about 45, 50 feet, and one of the shipmates above me was stepping on my hands. So I let go of the rope and went down about 25 feet and hit the water and started floating and swimming away from the ship. After that, we started congregating out in the sea. And because the Japanese were still in the area, the other ships couldn't turn their lights on because the Japs were still strafing us in the water and still firing at ships. So it was about 4 hours later that they began to pick us up and the lights came on, and they pulled me aboard a destroyer escort, and they picked up almost 400 of us, and I was fortunate to be put aboard the destroyer. We were given some alcohol nourishment. Most of us were very cold and had very little energy, and we took all our clothes off. They gave us new clothes. And the sailors on board that destroyer escort were very helpful in pulling all of us aboard and giving us some alcohol, either it was brandy or some other thing to take the chill off our bodies. And in those days, I wasn't familiar with that alcohol, so it was quite an exciting to get such heat in your stomach. So the next day, they took us into Iwo Jima and put us on a big transport and made it into a hospital ship. And it was right below Mount Suribachi. And later that morning, the skipper came on and announced to all of us, if they would look up on the mountain, you'll see the flag flying. And the flag went up on Iwo Jima, the one that most people in World War II recognize as a victory symbol for those Americans who wanted us to be successful in the war.
And I've heard a lot of stories that people have about where they were when they saw that flag go up, and it has symbolic value for just about everyone. But I imagine for you, as someone who's just had your ship sunk and you were almost killed, to see something like that probably had a lot of symbolic value for you.
It was very emotional to all of those sailors that were around me. They all were so enthused, and we were so happy that the Americans went up on that mountain and the Japs were still in that mountain because they were shooting at us in the harbor. And the Marines still got up there and put that flag up there. And the symbol of our flag sure is a freedom symbol to all the people of the world. I think we just can't imagine how much it means to us to see the flag flying and to know we're still free.
And I imagine you've seen the image of those Marines and a couple Navy guys raising the flag atop Mount Suribachi. You've probably seen that hundreds of times in the years since. Is it something where anytime you see that, you flash back to where you were on that day?
It's almost a daily occurrence, because not only do we have our reunions where we go over our experiences, but when you see an American flag in all our buildings, in government buildings, and it does bring back memories that so many Americans gave their lives so that we could enjoy ourselves today and in freedom and able to choose our elections in a big election coming up next week. I hope everyone gets out to vote.
Well, I think they can't argue with you, knowing what you've been through, and then to hear you say that. And for you, it means the freedom to come out here to Visalia Country Club and play golf three times a week. And I'm not going to mess with you on the golf course, because you would eat my lunch. But let's go back, because you brought us to that story of where you were when you saw Mount Suribachi, but that was a pretty eventful way that you ended up where you were. So you're on this carrier, and you mentioned the first suicide plane, the kamikaze. Now, had you seen a kamikaze attack before that day on February 21st?
Well, we did have some occasion to see them operate at Leyte, but not in this large numbers. And to see them, I was on the hangar deck, so I didn't get to see all of them flying, but my shipmates told me they usually like the Bendix air races. They were just running around those ships, firing at everybody, and I don't know why he chose our carrier, but they used it as a target, and they took us down.
Well, and that first one hit, and you weren't extremely close to that, but the second kamikaze that hit your ship, you told me you were how far away?
I was about maybe 30 or 40 yards on a hangar deck. It's a pretty long carrier. We're not real small, but next to those big ones, we're kind of tiny. But I was about 30, 40 yards away on the hangar deck going forward when that second one came.
Close enough to blow your jacket off your back.
Yes, yes. I didn't know how to sew very well, and I had safety wire going through my buttonhole, so I didn't have any buttons. So when that first one took me, it blew my jacket off. And I had to laugh because I had no buttons. And but when I got in the water, after spending about 4 hours or so in the water, it was very cold. People don't realize it, but the water was like, I don't know, they say it was like 57 degrees, and the swells were real high. I don't know, maybe 15 feet or so, maybe 20. And floating around there, after 3 or 4 hours, your body begins to feel the effects of the exposure. And it was very difficult when the destroyer escort came close. I could see the screws turning in the fantail, and they had the cargo net over to the side. I grabbed the cargo net, and I'm a pretty husky kid. I couldn't pull myself up. I was pretty weak. And those sailors, they were dragging us out. They reached down and pulled me up threw me on the deck, and they grabbed the next guy. They picked 400 of us up, and they were heroes too. I'm telling you, those sailors were really busy getting all of us survivors out of the water in very rough conditions.
Well, and it sounds like you're saying you wouldn't be here without them.
That's exactly right. Everyone I talked to at our reunions, most of them were picked up on the same escort carrier that I was. I mean, destroyer escort. And they mentioned the fact that those sailors did a marvelous job pulling us out of the water. And they're the ones that kept us from getting any further injury.
Well, I don't want to belabor the point, but I think everyone at home is trying to imagine themselves in your shoes or in your life preserver at that moment. And by the way, you still have a life preserver. And on our website at kmjnow.com, you can see a picture of what Steve looks like strapping one of those around his waist today with some other pictures, including a rendition of the Bismarck Sea being hit by those two kamikaze planes. But this is everybody's worst nightmare. Your ship has been hit. After 90 minutes, it's completely under the water. It's sunk. You're still floating in the water, not knowing if you'll ever be picked up. What was going through your mind? What kept you going? How did you survive that situation?
Well, what was so interesting about it was the fact that, one or two of my shipmates came by, and one had a leaking life preserver, and I showed them how to inflate it. There were little tubes along the side that you could release and blow the chambers up, and so I showed them how to do that. Another one came and did the same thing. And then I saw a group of 15 or 20 around a small life raft, and I figured I better not get too close. I'll stay away, and when the lights come on, they'll see that big group around that life raft, and I'll paddle closer to it so I can get aboard when they find them. So that was my experience in the water, and with a Jap strafing us there, that was a very dastardly deed. I was really amazed that they would do that.
Because you guys are defenseless in the water. You can't fire at them.
Yeah, you see the bullets hitting the water, and you just hope that they don't get you.
How close did they come to you?
Well, I was maybe about 15, 20 feet away from the splashes of the bullets. But fortunately, you could hear some screams going on. A lot of the guys got hit. And one of the reports that was written about our night's attack explains that we lost quite a few boys in the water because of the strafing.
And in total, more than 300 men from your ship died that day?
We had a total, I think it went around 321 or two that never made it and that were missing. And we put a plaque on there in their honor on the Yorktown. I think it's in Charleston. And we dedicated this monument with all the names of those that didn't make it and to honor them for what they did to preserve our freedom.
You know, I don't want to put any words in your mouth or put my thoughts in yours, but I'm just wondering if you spent 4 hours in the water and you had talked about when you heard the news of Pearl Harbor, you were singing in your church choir. So as a guy raised in the Orthodox Church with your Russian heritage, saying a few prayers while you're floating in the water for 4 hours?
Well, I think it was a constant memory of if the Lord's going to help me, now's the time to do his job because we're so busy trying to stay afloat, and my preserver wasn't that functional. I had to blow it up a couple times, and the only thing was that when we're on board ship, we had to wear this. It was a life preserver, and it was the order of the day. Everybody wore one of those belts. So when we went over the side, most everyone that I was familiar with had one of these on.
What do you think the chances are that you would have survived without one of those?
Very nil. I'm not a very good swimmer, and to be in the water that long, I don't know how to float very well. I can dog paddle a while, but I couldn't have done it for 3 hours because that's how long it took before they were able to pick me up, almost 4 hours.
Well, there's more to come with Steve Marusich. When we come back, we'll hear about the recovery from the injuries he suffered that day. He has the Purple Heart here as proof of that. He also has a poem that was written about the ordeal of the sailors on the USS Bismarck Sea back on February 21st of 1945. So maybe we'll have him read that for us when we come back. We'll come down the home stretch of Hometown Heroes next. This is News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. As usual, the time goes by way too fast. Just a reminder, next week we will not have Hometown Heroes because of Bulldog football preempted because of a game at Louisiana Tech. There's a Louisiana connection to something you're just going to hear from Steve Marusich here in a moment. We're coming to you from Tulare County today, the Visalia Country Club, where Steve is a three-time club champion. He's now 86 years old. He's going to shoot his age again one of these days. And he's been telling us about the day the Japanese were shooting at him as he floated in the water. His carrier, the USS Bismarck Sea, sunk off of Iwo Jima on February 21st of 1945. And one thing that has really made you emotional over the years, Steve, and brought you back some of those memories, is a poem that one of your shipmates wrote. It's called "The Night I Heard Men Cry." Why don't you tell us about the gentleman who wrote that poem? I guess he's from Lafayette, Louisiana?
Yes, Jocko LeBlanc was a young enlisted man, and he went in when he was 17 years old. And I never got to meet him until we had our reunions. And I'm telling you, he was about 6'5", big, tall, southern gentleman from Lafayette. And I'm telling you, he was a lot of fun. And we often, after we got off and got our reunions going, why, he was one of the real joys to meet and to talk to and reminisce about our days aboard the carrier.
And you've got your glasses on. I'll try to keep the microphone out of your line of sight, and I'll let you read his poem for us, "The Night I Heard Men Cry."
It was a February night in 45, while aboard the Carrier 95, in the waters of Iwo we rode high. I heard men cry. Yes, I saw men die. Through the twilight of the battle raged on. At a time like this, you feel all alone. The sky lit up like the 4th of July, and I heard men cry. Yes, I saw men die. Out of the tracer-filled sky, the enemy did come, hell-bent on scoring one for the rising sun. A kamikaze hit us broadside, and again I heard men cry, and I saw men die. Our faithful old ship split apart at the seam. Above the hellish noise, I heard men scream. She belched up fire with a mournful sigh, and I heard men cry, and I saw men die. The captain called out, "Abandon ship." We knew then it was the end of the trip. More hell rained down from the sky, and I heard men cry. Yes, I saw men die. 500 men died that dismal night. 500 more lived through that awful plight. On the ocean floor our ship came to lie, and I heard men cry, and I saw men die. Maybe 1,000 men died that night. It was hard to tell. 1,000 brave men we knew so well. I could be one who took that ride, for I still hear men cry, and I still see men die. Jocko LeBlanc, seaplane captain in the USS Bismarck Sea.
Now, I think everybody at home just got a very clear picture of what happened that night in February of 1945. Does that make it more real to you, the memories, when you read his poem?
Yes, because as we got together in our reunions later on, we've had about 30 reunions, and almost without question, everyone that comes somehow always reverts back to the night that Japanese got our ship. So the memories are always lingering there, and we lost a lot of friends that night. And those were the heroes in fighting for the freedom of America.
Well, and we can tell how powerful that is for you still. There's one question that I don't take lightly, but I think is important to ask. And I think I know the answer to it, and seeing what you've done with your life. And everyone who heard you recite that poem can hear how sharp you are at age 86. They can hear the teacher and the principal in you, I think. And people who had you in Ivanhoe will certainly remember that. But did you feel a responsibility moving forward in your life to make something of it because you easily could have been one of those hundreds of sailors who died that night?
Yes, I came back to Binghamton and then went to work for IBM again. And fortunately, I got a job working the night shift. I worked 11 to 7 in the morning, and that's when I tuned up my golf game. I played almost every day. I had brothers that played, and I had a lot of friends that played, so we did a lot. And so I learned the game pretty well. And then one day I told my dad I'm going to go to college on a GI Bill, and he really cried that night, and I don't think I ever saw him cry before. But I went to school at a school in Western Colorado, Western State College, and then I was fortunate to get a master's degree at Stanford University. I married my young bride that year, and we got a job in Visalia at Old Elbow School, and that was in 1952, and I've been fortunate to stay here, and we've lived here ever since.
You never would have met your wife, you never would have had your son or any grandkids if you hadn't survived that night in February of 45.
That's true. And the Lord was on my side, and he gave me one of the best women I've ever known in my life. She was, well, anyway, we had 56 years of married life. We had one son, he got two grandchildren, and I know that whatever we had together are memories that I'll cherish the rest of my life.
And now at age 86, you still have a lot of passion. I think we can all hear that. One thing that you've done in recent years, first at Golden West High School and now at Woodlake High School, you're part of a group of veterans that go and share your stories with high school students. Why is that important to you? And if there's one thing about that time in our history that you try to convey to these young minds, what is that most important thing for us to remember?
Well, you see now, after so many years, 60 years or whatever it was, a lot of the history books don't emphasize the importance of the World War II. In the history books, you're lucky to get a half a page about our efforts, and we just saved the world and took care of the Japanese and the Germans. And I'm telling you that when I visit these schools at Woodlake High School, Mr. Hernandez has a program for us there, and the students come and talk to us, and we tell them about our experiences. And I am amazed, and I think you people will be too, that after I've been talking to these children, these students, they have sent me letters in response to our visit. And you can be proud that some of these young Americans, these high school students, are genuinely interested in what our work was in preserving the freedom of our great country.
Absolutely. Well, Steve, we're out of time on the program, but thank you so much for sharing those stories with us. Thank you for serving our country and for keeping the memory of all those men on the Bismarck Sea alive.
Yes, and Paul, I'm just thrilled that I had an opportunity to talk the people that listen to your program, and I hope they'll understand that the boys and ladies and young men and women that are fighting for our country in other parts of the world, it's the same as we did 65 years ago. It's still for the freedom not only of our country, but those free people that want to have the freedom we have in other parts of the world. I'm just pleased that I'm still around to enjoy the few days that are left for me. But anyway, I'm glad I survived, and I think the Lord was on my side.
I am not going to argue with you there, and I look forward to hearing about your next hole-in-one, which will be your fourth, or when you next shoot your age. That's Steve Marusich of Ivanhoe, California. He's been our guest today. If you want to see some pictures of this good-looking young man, see his Purple Heart, see his aircraft carrier, go to kmjnow.com or visit the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening on News Talk 580 KMJ.